Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This edition of The Week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. This week, three stories from The Scientist Daily News. One about a study that suggests statins may stop tumors. A second story that says the hobbit, the tiny hominid found on the island of Flores in 2003, might be human after all. And a third on what will happen at the World Health Organization after the unexpected death of its chief this week. First, a story by Melissa Lee Phillips on a study that suggests that statins may stop tumors. Inhibitors of cholesterol synthesis, such as statin drugs, may impede growth of some tumors, according to a paper in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The authors found that sterols and their derivatives have a critical effect on sonic hedgehog, or SHH signaling pathway in medulloblastoma cells, suggesting that blocking sterols could stop medulloblastoma and other SHH-dependent tumors. David Robbins of Dartmouth Medical School in Hanover, New Hampshire, said, quote, "The implication for treatment of human cancer is actually pretty good. Medulloblastoma cells seem to be very susceptible to changes in cholesterol biosynthesis," end quote. When it's unregulated, SHH signaling promotes the formation of human tumors, especially medulloblastoma and basal cell carcinoma. A loss-of-function mutation in the tumor suppressor gene, called PATCHD, is the most common mutation underlying uncontrolled SHH signaling. The PATCHD protein normally inhibits downstream SHH target genes by blocking function of the protein called smoothened. Scientists have shown that SHH signaling pathway depends on sterol synthesis, according to senior author Matthew Scott of Stanford University. But it wasn't known which member of the sterol synthetic pathway was the key ingredient. A part of that pathway, acetyl coenzyme A, is converted into isoprenoids, then to sterols, and finally to steroids. Matthew Scott and Ryan Corcoran, also of Stanford, treated mouse medulloblastoma cells with inhibitors that block various steps of the sterol synthetic pathway. They found that all inhibitors which block steps upstream of the cholesterol synthesis reduced medulloblastoma cell proliferation. Scott says that an inhibitor that blocked the conversion of sterols to steroids, however, had no effect on cell proliferation, suggesting that cholesterol or a derivative is likely the crucial product in medulloblastoma cell proliferation. The researchers also found that the inhibitor which reduced medulloblastoma cell proliferation reduced the expression of patched proteins and of the SHH target gene called GLI-1, to an extent similar to that of the known SHH pathway inhibitor cyclopamine. The inhibition of both SHH signaling and medulloblastoma cell proliferation was reversed when the researchers added back cholesterol or one of several oxysterol derivatives of cholesterol. Scott says that some oxysterols encourage proliferation more strongly than unmodified cholesterol, but it's impossible to know which molecule is regulating this pathway in vivo. Corcoran and Scott also showed that the proliferative effects of an oxysterol can be blocked by a known smoothened inhibitor, which they say suggests that sterols normally activate smoothened. Commenting on the study, Anna Marie Kenny of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York said, quote, "The paper has really widespread implications for a large field. All of the hedgehog family members signal through a very highly conserved mechanism, so other cancers where the hedgehog pathway is involved may also be sensitive to sterols," end quote. Cynthia Wetmore of the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota, agreed that the data is convincing, but the results may not be entirely predictive of how human tumor cells would react. She said, quote, "All of the experiments were performed on mouse tumor cells with P53 mutations, and it's possible that this mutation, which is not usually seen in human tumors, could affect their results," end quote. Wetmore adds that since medulloblastoma usually affects children, it's important to investigate whether cholesterol synthesis inhibitors influence normal brain development. "Cholesterol and lipid metabolism is very important to the developing brain," she said, "and it remains to be seen if the statins are specific for tumor cells." Scott says that if the results from the cell culture hold up in living tissue, it may be possible to develop a treatment that combines cholesterol synthesis inhibitors, such as the statins used to lower cholesterol levels in people at risk of cardiovascular disease, with smoothenid antagonists, which are already in clinical trials as cancer treatments. Says Robbins, quote, "There are lots of hedgehog-dependent tumor cells that are affected by these smoothenid antagonists. The idea of combining a cholesterol biosynthetic inhibitor with a smoothenid antagonist is an attractive one," end quote. Next, Tammy Powledge writes that the tiny hominid found on the Indonesian island of Flores in 2003 might be human after all. Scientists have moved their debate over the origins of the hobbit onto the pages of this week's Science magazine. In the journal, two groups of authors argue whether or not the hobbit, the bizarre-looking tiny hominid that is estimated to be 18,000 years old and unearthed on the Indonesian island of Flores in 2003, is a new human species or just a member of Homo sapiens with microcephaly, a heterogeneous head and brain deformity. Robert Martin, primatologist at Chicago's Field Museum, told the scientist, quote, "I don't expect this to settle the argument, but I'm relieved that we got something published in a peer-reviewed journal." In the journal, Martin and his colleagues critique a 2005 Science paper that analyzed the endocast of the skull from the hobbit's type specimen LB1 and compared it to a single microcephalic skull. Based on the results, the 2005 paper concluded that LB1 was not microcephalic. Martin and his team, however, argue that the LB1's skull shares characteristics with other microcephalic skulls collected from humans, suggesting that microcephaly is still a strong possibility. The authors of the 2005 paper, led by Dean Falk, endocast expert at Florida State University in Tallahassee, respond in the journal that Martin and his colleagues do not provide comparative measurements and photos of their microcephalic skulls, making conclusions impossible. Falk told the scientist that Martin and his colleagues' criticisms are historically familiar. Quote, "When important fossils are discovered, there's always a brouhaha, always people who say they're pathological," end quote. Both papers predict hominid brain sizes by comparing hominids to other mammals, but that can produce misleading results, said William L. Jungers, State University of New York at Stony Brook, quote, "There's no law of mammalian brain scaling. Based on our size, you would never predict that humans have the brains that we have," end quote. Jungers was not on the discovery team, but is analyzing hobbit postcranial remains. He notes that, quote, "We don't have good models for predicting brain size evolution in any human lineage," end quote. Experts not involved with either group say it may never be clear whether LB1 was microcephalic because the condition is so diverse. According to medical geneticist Judith Hall, LB1's teeth are too large and bones too thick to be an example of microcephalic osteodysplastic primordial dwarfism. The dwarfism is the only specific suggestion in the Martin Group's paper. However, Hall, who is at Vancouver Children's Hospital and has studied the disorder, told the scientist that microcephaly of some previously unknown kind is perfectly plausible in an inbred group. Ralph Holloway of Columbia University, who has studied endocasts of LB1 and microcephalics, said that LB1's brain has several peculiar features, but they don't resemble microcephalics he's examined. Holloway says it is possible that pathology does exist, but last year the discovery team reported finding a second small mandible very much like LB1's, which is what Holloway calls, quote, "a very serious nail in the coffin of pathology," end quote. John Hawks, anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin, told the scientist that he agrees that the second jaw is the strongest evidence for LB1 being a representative hobbit, but he believes LB1's skeleton displays odd features that may be pathological. As it happens, discussions in scientific venues are moving from hobbit skulls to hobbit skeletons, but it's unclear whether this new evidence will clarify classification. Finally, Stephen Pinnock ponders the future of the World Health Organization after the untimely death this week of its chief, Lee Jong-wook. The United Nations health body is left with some difficult decisions to make about how to find his successor. Susanna Jacob, director of the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, said that, in light of issues such as avian influenza, quote, "it comes at the worst possible time for the WHO. You need leadership, and the leadership is now gone," end quote. This week, WHO announced it was appointing Anders Nordstrom, Director General for General Management, as Acting Director General. Meanwhile, representatives of member countries in Geneva for the ongoing World Health Assembly are now pondering how to appoint the next permanent Director General. The process will begin in earnest next week when the WHO Executive Board comes together for a scheduled meeting where they will consider a range of options for how to proceed, according to Christine McNabb, spokeswoman for the WHO Director General's office. One of those options could be to open a call for nominations to the post as early as this week. Under normal procedures, when electing a new Director General, the board would not meet to consider the nominations until January 2007, and would then make a recommendation that would be put to the next World Health Assembly in May that year for ratification. But given that Lee's death leaves WHO without an appointed leader, the board could choose to make a selection earlier, says McNabb, and even call an extraordinary World Health Assembly to ratify the new appointment quickly. Moga Kamal, health advisor for the international charity Oxfam and a close observer of the WHO, thinks a candidate could be chosen and ratified well before the end of the year. She said, quote, "What is very important is to get a really good leader, one who is visionary and can really inspire his staff to go with him. We also need a good manager, one who can combine a focus on diseases with attention on health systems. The onus is now on member states to find somebody with those attributes," end quote. Jacob added that Nordstrom was a good choice as the interim head, but a year without a full director general would be hard on WHO. Jacob herself previously spent 12 years in senior roles at WHO in Europe. Lee was a director general of the WHO since 2003. He died on the morning of May 22nd at the age of 61 after surgery to remove a blood clot in his brain. Lee's ambitious goals for WHO included the 3x5 plan that aimed to provide 3 million people with HIV/AIDS in poor countries with access to treatment by the end of 2005. Kamal says, quote, "I think that will be his greatest legacy," end quote. She noted that Oxfam considers the 3x5 program a success because of the way it improved access to antiretroviral drugs, even though its ambitious targets had not been met. Lee's tenure was also characterized by a strong push to decentralize WHO, including moving staff out of the headquarters and into country and regional offices. Says Jacob, quote, "He really started a serious decentralization in WHO toward the regions and the countries. He said, let's put our resources in the places where our priorities lie. His loss will be deeply felt by the organization. He really was a global leader in public health. He took up the battle to make sure that priority was given to countries that had the greatest need," end quote. Join us online at www.the-scientist.com for more of the Scientist Daily News, blogs on current events, controversies and conferences, and features from our May print edition. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.